This October, Tanger invites you to shop pink and save lives. Your donation of $10 or more to the Breast Cancer Research Foundation helps fuel innovative research that brings us closer to a cure. It also unlocks exclusive savings from brands like Coach, Crocs, Columbia Factory Store, and more to shop all month long. Join us as we mark 30 years of advancing research and empowering hope. Donate and access your exclusive savings today at Tanger.com. Hmm? Ah! Hmm.
Hey there, peoples of Middle Earth. Welcome to our podcast. I'm Anwen.
And I'm Penny.
And this is the Cast of the Rings, episode 10.
This episode, we are bringing you a season wrap-up of The Lord of the Rings, The Rings of Power, season 1.
So exciting to be able to look back on it with a couple of weeks' perspective. How about you, Penny?
Oh, I feel the same way. And I've missed podcasting with you, so it's nice to be back on the long-distance internet.
me too, absolutely. And I was thinking about this as well, that I just so appreciate the magic of podcasting. I've really, really enjoyed podcasting with you, and I just love that with a couple of microphones and a little bit of software that somebody in New Zealand and somebody on the east coast of the US can feel like we're in the same room talking about something and then send it out to the world with the help of our amazing editors. So I just think it's fantastic, and wanted to shout out to Podcastica Network as well. For those of you who've just found us through this podcast and maybe yet to explore the rest of Podcastica, it all started back in 2010 when Jason and Karen just decided to put together a little podcast on a show called The Walking Dead. And it just grew and grew and grew from there. And to this date, I think we've done about, covered about 45 to 50 shows. Like, I think even Jason's lost count. There's so many. All of the shows, amazing shows that Strange Indeed has covered, or the main show. There's all of the Star Wars TV shows that have been covered. So many TV shows. And, you know, obviously House of Dragon has been a big one recently. And it's just incredible that this community has grown from just that one little conversation that Jason and Karen had all those years ago. So I'm really grateful for it and really excited to be part of it.
And one of my favorite parts about podcasting and the Podcastica Network is the community and the listener feedback that we get. I love hearing from other fans of these wonderful TV shows that we love, what they think, especially when we get calls and emails and comments from people we've never heard from before at all. It's really exciting. So you guys out there, you know, don't be shy. If it's only one sentence, send it in. We love hearing from you.
Exactly. And I've also really enjoyed recently listening to the extended feedback episodes on Walking Dead cast. Now that they're coming to the end of the season, they're doing a separate show for the feedback. And I've really enjoyed hearing people who have written or called in for the first time, and especially hearing about how they found the network. So someone recently said that they found it because of Yellow Jackets, and that's how that was their gateway into Podcastica. Other people have been there from the start with the Walking Dead cast. And I really appreciate hearing how people have found us in their various ways. So keep the feedback coming, because we absolutely love it. So for this episode, we are going to be discussing the whole of season one for The Lord of the Rings, The Rings of Power, right up to the finale. And we're sort of looking at this as a perspective of the season as a whole. So if you haven't seen all of it, just be warned that the whole season will be spoiled for you. But hopefully by this stage, you've had a chance to see them all. And each episode that we covered, we kind of looked at each single episode of the show. But now it's a really good chance for us to kind of look back on the season as a whole. And Penny, you said that you've gone back and looked again at some of the episodes since it finished.
Yeah, I rewatched the battle episode, which I think is episode 8, when Mount Doom explodes. And I rewatched the one right after that, where they all simply walk out of Mordor.
yeah.
And then I ran out of time. Yeah. I was going to watch the final one, but it was fun to revisit and see it again and have it just sort of refreshed in my mind. And there was stuff that I saw that I hadn't noticed before. So I was like, oh my God, there's still more to see in this show. There's like so much detail.
Yeah, crazy. I love doing a rewatch with perspective. I haven't done that yet, but I am looking forward to watching the whole season with my kids because they haven't seen it yet. So to see it from the beginning, knowing what's coming, I think can be really helpful, especially when I think, you know, looking back some of those earlier episodes, we were kind of going, where are they going with this and what's going to happen? And that, not that it takes away from it, but it does add that extra layer of kind of, you know, consideration, whereas later if you can go, you can just kind of let it wash over you and go, yeah, this is awesome, it's when I know where it's going, so I just enjoy it.
It's going to be really fun to watch it with your kids. I'm a little jealous of that. That's going to be really cool.
Yeah, it's going to be great. They do love the Lord of the Rings movies, so I think we're going to go back, watch this, and then we'll probably end up doing the rest of the movies too as we do our rewatch and podcast on those ones as well. So lots of material to get through the long wait that we have to endure over the next year and a half to 2 years potentially.
Exactly.
Yeah.
There's a lot. It's a long time.
It is. So looking back now, Penny, what are your overall thoughts of the season one?
I think it was mostly a success. That visually, it's hard to even compare it to any other shows. The scope and the sweeping nature of the visuals and the beauty and the detail work was really powerful. Some of the pacing and some of the, you know, dialogue issues that other people have pointed out and think are like the end of the world, I think are sort of growing pains that you get when you have to do such tremendous world building. And I have a feeling that season two is going to run much more smoothly now that they've done all the work of establishing these different communities and civilizations and locations.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. In fact, my notes are almost identical to what you've just said, Penny. I think we're on the same page. But
that's wonderful.
I'm the same. And look, you know, the one of the ways that I can kind of judge it, I guess, is that every week I couldn't wait to see the next episode. So that's always a good sign. Even if there are little bits and pieces that you maybe question or don't enjoy as much, I think knowing that you're looking forward to it, it's appointment TV. And of course, we were lucky enough to get it a couple of days early. And so when I got the chance to sit down and watch it each week, I was super excited. So that's always a good sign.
Yeah.
I think
when we didn't get the finale, we were both so upset.
I sat down 2 days early to watch it all excited and I was like, and then I clicked on the link, there was nothing there, and I went, of course they wouldn't send us that early, that would be stupid.
Yeah, but I was like, we're trustworthy, I swear. Yeah, it's just, I really wanted it.
Yeah, but it was there was something cool about waiting till everyone gets it. Yeah. It's a little bit like with the Walking Dead, they're not letting AMC Plus viewers get to watch that early either. Everyone gets to see it at the same time, and I like that. It's cool.
Yeah. For the finale, it's really important.
Yeah. But I think overall, especially from the very beginning when I was anticipating the series, one of the things that lived up to my expectations was simply just seeing Middle Earth on screen again. That was the biggest thing for me. Was I absolutely adored the Lord of the Rings trilogy, and to see it on screen again 20 years later was really, really special. I loved the visuals as well. I just couldn't fault the design, the costumes, the visual effects, the casting, like the way everything and everyone looked, with just one or two little exceptions I'll probably go into later. But in general, the music, the sound design, everything was amazing. And I love that they shot a lot of it on location with so many recognizable parts of New Zealand. And
yeah, that's exciting.
I agree with you, the pacing and the writing, like, sometimes it was a little bit clunky, but I do feel like it's sort of teething issues, like you say. And I think a lot of that is to do with the inexperienced showrunners. They're brand new to this kind of thing. And I do think that they would have learned a huge amount. I hope that they learned a huge amount from the first season and maybe some of the feedback and just the experience of doing it, so that by the time they get to the second season, that's a little bit smoother. I was sort of, it was such a feast for the senses overall that I was able to get past some of the liberties that they took with the lore, which again, I'll go into a little bit later. For the overall story, you know, I just think it was spectacular. So I was overall really pleased with the whole thing.
So we both saw separately that the OneRing.net had released their report card for the first season of The Rings of Power. And you can go on the OneRing.net and find this, people out there, but I'll just read through it. Visuals, A. Acting, A. Pacing, C minus. Writing, C. Fidelity, C minus. SFX and VFX, A. Music, A plus. Mixing, A. GFX and titles, B minus. Marketing, B minus. Overall production, B minus.
Yeah, what do you think about that? I kind of think it's a little harsh, do you?
Yeah, I think it's a little harsh. I also don't completely understand like how they came up with these specific categories. I find mixing to be a funny category next to some of the others, but whatever. I agree on the visuals in SFX and VFX. Those are A's, and the music is fantastic, A+. But I think they're a little harsh on the writing and the graphics and titles. Like, what was their problem there?
Yeah, I thought the graphics were amazing, and the opening titles were outstanding.
They're beautiful.
I thought. Yeah,
yeah, and the maps. I don't know which category the maps go into, but those maps were gorgeous. Especially that leather-looking one. It was so amazing.
Yeah,
like I would have given graphics and titles an A.
I gave it an A plus.
Yeah.
I went A for graphics and titles, and A plus for the visuals. As I said, I couldn't really fault that at all.
Yeah.
And I think, I mean, I guess probably some of my lower ratings would have gone to the writing, the pacing, and the fidelity. And I can go into that a little bit more. I think with the pacing, I felt in particular that the last episode was rushed. I felt like they spent a lot of time talky-talky, walky-walky out of Mordor. It's like episode 7 was kind of, I thought, one of the weaker episodes, although there were moments in there that I did love in terms of the dialogue between Galadriel and Theo and just some of that softening of Galadriel's character there and some other moments in that episode as well. But in general, I thought it was one of the weaker ones, and I thought they could have spent a little bit less time on there, maybe a tiny little bit less time on Half-Foots, although I did enjoy them. But I just felt that the things that I had been looking forward to so much, which was Sauron or Halbrand getting to the elves and doing his trickery and the starting of the rings. I had expected that. I had wanted to relish that for longer. It was so delicious when it came, but it was so quick. He walks into the forge. Hey, have you thought of doing this? Think of it as a gift. Oh my God. Like, I knew that was coming from the start. You know, I was 100%. Well,
yeah.
I wavered sometimes. There was a couple of times when I was maybe 80% Sauron, but most of the time I was pretty sure it was Halbrand, and I wanted to see him get there. And when he did, it was wonderful, but it felt too quick. I just thought.
Yeah, it was like 10 minutes.
Yeah, and like it was satisfying, but I would have been satisfied enough with just him walking in at the very end of the episode. Like, I think that would have been enough of a teaser for next season to go.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I guess, you know, the viewers that aren't as familiar with the lore, they did need to have it more obvious and a more kind of distinct conclusion. So I see what they did with it. But overall, I think just that pacing, there were some things that could have been done quicker and some things that I wanted to take a bit more time with. And I you know, they've got 5 seasons. They've got time to stretch out and get much more into that, I think. It's tricky. What about any of those other ratings?
I mean, the fidelity rating doesn't matter that much to me since I don't know all the lore. So it's mostly fresh to me, and it's close enough to what I remember from reading Lord of the Rings that it's fine. The pacing was a little herky-jerky. So maybe I would have given the pacing a C or C plus, writing a B, fidelity. I'm not grading on fidelity. Marketing, I don't even know why they're grading on marketing. I think that's kind of ridiculous. But I would give a grading on representation because I love that this production included people of color and people of color like throughout the different races of Middle Earth. Although orcs are all kind of gray. So I guess they're just all people of color or none people of color. I don't know what we think about orcs.
They're just kind of scabby.
Yeah, they're just gray and gross. I really thought they did a beautiful job of casting people of color in a way that didn't feel like they were like, look, we have people. You know, it was just like, that's their character. They're not like the elves who are from a different part of Middle Earth. They're just, some of the elves have darker skin. Some of the dwarves have darker skin. It was fine. I really enjoyed that. And you know how I feel about the representation of women throughout. It's just that it's so weird that there's like only one female elf that talks or has a name or has even shows her face. All the other female elves are wearing like veils and stuff. It really bothers me.
Yeah.
There are other female dwarves that were like in the background, but none of them have names or anything. And the Harfoots are the only like civilization where it seemed like the women were fully members of the civilization there. Even the Numenoreans, it seemed like a really big deal that Aarion got to be an apprentice. And, you know, Muriel's the queen regent, but it's always different for nobility. There weren't any other women in any other, like, apparent positions of power. And you know, there weren't women advisors. I didn't see women guards or women in any of the soldiers were women or sailors. So I think they could do better there. So representation B.
Yeah. Again, something that maybe they can work on. And I think some of that could be, and this is not me making excuses for them, but I think some of the stuff around the women elves, for this point in the story, it's really Galadriel. That's the pivotal one to the plot. And we're going to be seeing, hopefully later on, some more, at least one more female elf who is going to be key to the story. So, let's see what happens with that. I think, a fairly good start, at least. And exactly. We've talked before about, you know, the people who didn't like the representation. Well, they can just go and take a jump into the fiery pit of Mount Doom because we're not here for that.
exactly.
Yeah. I think the visual tone particularly, I think they got this just right. So There's two parts to this. There's how amazing it just looked, like how visually it just was, you know, like I said, a feast for the senses. It's beautiful to look at. I've heard a lot of people say it's the most beautiful TV show they've ever seen. But the other part to that is the visual tone and how it fits in with what we already know of Middle Earth or what we've seen before of Middle Earth. I think this is probably really difficult to get right, and I think they have got it right. So, you know, most people are very familiar visually with the world of Peter Jackson's Lord of the Rings trilogy. That's how a lot of people see Middle Earth. And a lot of the visuals from that were based on the drawings from Alan Lee and John Howe, who were the two who had illustrated the most recent publications of the Lord of the Rings books. So they were hired onto Peter Jackson's film as concept artists. And so a lot of the visuals that you see, if you go back to the more recent, over the last sort of, you know, 30, 40 years of the publication of the books, a lot of the big color plates that you see in those large format books were artworks, paintings by Alan Lee and John Howe. So it already matched what a lot of people had in their minds from seeing the books and from the visual representation of that translated to the Peter Jackson movies. And then now they had to, with this, I think, make it look like it was the same world, but they sort of managed to make it the world look younger. So we're 3,000, 4,000 years prehistory of Middle Earth from the world that we're used to with, you know, Frodo and Sam and all of them. So I think they did that really well. They made the colors look brighter and kind of more saturated. You know, with most obvious, I think, with the elves. So in the Peter Jackson films, it was all very autumnal. You know, it was sort of muted colors, darker greens, oranges and dark kind of yellows to sort of show that the elves were waning and they were in their kind of autumn of their years in Middle Earth. And I think here we see it a lot more greener and fresher. And overall, the whole look was sort of a bit younger and fresher and a bit more saturated. It was less grimy, except mm-hmm. for where it was needed. You know, there was obviously some scenes and some peoples that needed to look a bit more grimy, but I feel like they did that really well. And that they kind of had the license to do what they liked with Numenor, mm-hmm. know, because it's the first time we've seen that on screen. It does fit with descriptions from the book, while also looking a little bit like the architecture, which eventually became, you know, familiar to us in Rohan and Gondor. So the armor and the costumes were really good to kind of show, oh, well, this is obviously how this evolved into what we see later in Gondor, which was really great. I felt like the Harfoots looked like ancestors of the hobbits. I think they got the personalities right. They kind of matched that comical nature, but also the heart and the earnestness that the hobbits have later, while still making them seem a bit more wild and a little bit more nomadic and all the things that are slightly different from those settled hobbits that we saw later. So that tone of the sort of styling of it, I think, was spot on. I don't think they could have done that any better.
I have to agree with you. It's very natural feeling as a relator, as it relates to the Peter Jackson films. As I've said before, I only saw the first of the Hobbit films, so I can't comment really on how the aesthetics of those films match up. But for me, this looked like an extension of the world I'd been imagining since I was, you know, like 9 years old.
That's great. And that's the key, isn't it, for a lot of people, that's what makes it amazing to see on screen, is that we've imagined it and then we get to see it again, which is really, really great.
It's magical when the thing in your head shows up in front of you like that. It's not a lot of adaptations of books do that. You know, there's so many times when you go to see a film or a TV show of a book that you've loved and you're like, oh, what were they thinking? But in this case, it all feels like they get the essence of it. Like, the details may be different, but the vibe and the heart of what Middle Earth looks like and feels like in my head is on screen.
That's great. Yeah, I agree. And what about, have you got any, like, I've got some more good things to say, especially about characters and things like that. But I have got a couple of nitpicks, so I thought maybe we could get them out of the way. Have you got anything that you wanted to pick the nits on?
I think I'm still upset that Poppy didn't go with Nori and the Stranger at the end of the season. I'm hoping that's so that something happens and then Poppy goes after them. It's the only hope I have about that, because I don't understand why she's not with them. It really upset me, and it still upsets me. And the thing about all the, you know, elf women with veils and not talking, those are the big ones for me.
Yeah, I wonder with Poppy, and I agree, knowing what we know of their two characters, it would make total sense that she would go. I wonder how much was that they didn't want to make it exactly the same as Lord of the Rings. Like, it's so Sam and Frodo, isn't it? And I wonder whether they intentionally wanted to make it different, at least at the start. You know, she's got more people with her, so she's got the other two along with the Stranger. I just wonder whether they're going to bring that in later or not. I definitely see what you mean. It didn't seem to fit completely with what we know of their characters, but maybe there's, again, we might have the perspective later of being able to go, oh, okay, that's why they did it.
Yeah. It sits uncomfortably with me. But most of the other relationships felt really real, and some especially felt like impressively lived in. Like, Elendil and Isildur, like, they love and annoy each other, and at the same time, you know what I mean? Like, they're constantly, like, trying to connect and not quite connecting, and it feels like that's been going on for 10 or 15 or 20 years with them.
Yeah, I love that. When you only have, you know, if you added up the number of minutes that they're on screen together, it's probably pretty minimal. But the fact that they did make it seem realistic, that they had, you're coming in the middle of a conversation that's maybe 10 years long. So it's nice that they make it seem realistic from that viewpoint. And it is hard when you're world building for the whole series, you know, of 40 or 50 episodes or whatever it is. It's you got to do that quickly, but you also can't gloss over things. So I think that was well done too. I agree.
But not every relationship rang true. Farazan and his son seemed like they had only just met. Like there was a quality about their relationship. And when Farazan was giving his son, you know, his fatherly wisdom, that felt like it was something new and not something lived in and habitual to me.
Yeah, even to the point where he's telling him something and then he says, my son. And you kind of go, oh, okay, they're telling us he's his son. It didn't seem as obvious from the beginning with the two of them. Yeah, I don't know where they're going. I just, no idea where they're going with him. No idea where they're going with Iarian. So that's wait and see, I think, on those guys.
At Humana, our Medicare Advantage plans give you coverage and care you can count on, along with guided support to help you feel your best. You could have a plan with a $0 premium or an all-in-one plan that may include medical and prescription coverage, as well as routine dental, vision, and hearing. Learn more at GetHumana.com. Humana, a more human way to healthcare. Humana is a Medicare Advantage HMO and PPO organization with a Medicare contract. Enrollment in any Humana plan depends on contract renewal. The Humana Honor Medicare Advantage plan gives you $1,860 back each year in your Social Security check. Choose coverage that helps you keep more money in your pocket. Learn more at GetHumana.com. Humana, a more human way to healthcare. The Part B Give Back benefit pays part or all of your Part B premium, and the amount may change based on the amount you pay for Part B. Limitations and restrictions may apply. Humana is a Medicare Advantage HMO and PPO organization with a Medicare contract. Enrollment in any Humana plan depends on contract renewal.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
I guess my main nitpick is a little bit to do with the lore, and I'm not going to go to the extreme of some people who, you know, just totally boycotted the show because it was an abomination of Tolkien's writing. Like, that's just not it's just a couple of little things that I don't think were that necessary, but I'll talk through those now. So, I mean, some of the things you have to change to make sense in this medium. And there's this thing called the Tom Shippey test. I don't know if you've heard of it, but Tom Shippey was one of the like preeminent Tolkien scholars. And apparently he was actually consulting on the show early on as well. And he was also an expert of English medieval literature. He is also quite an expert on sci-fi and fantasy. Like, he knows his stuff, this guy. But the Shippey test is basically when you adapt something to the screen from writings, there's two main questions that you have to ask yourself. The first one is, are the themes and the main ideas of the story represented and ring true? And then the second one is, are any changes that are made from that necessary for the actual medium that you're using? And I do feel that overall that it does pass the Shippey test, this show. But I think that they've kept the main themes, they've kept the main ideas, and they've made the changes where needed. You know, sometimes you have to, especially this condensing of the timeline, like we're doing 5 seasons, you have to have some through characters that aren't just elves. You know, the elves are really beautiful to look at. They're pretty interesting, but they're, you know, we all know that they're pretty haughty and think highly of themselves. And if it was only elves that we got to see for the whole 5 seasons, it might be a little bit annoying.
So just like humans come through and they live and they die and they live and they die. I mean, it would be really hard to ever give a crap about any of them.
Exactly. And you like this condensing of the timeline to include Isildur and Elendil 1500 years too early for the actual story. You know the reason is it's the essential story elements are the same, and with Isildur and Elendil, I don't have a problem that they've condensed it. I think it serves the purpose of the story that we are engaged with these characters and that we see their through story across the 5 seasons, and it wouldn't work for me if they had influence over things that were too early in the story for them to be part of, such as the forging of the rings. They're nothing to do with that in the story. They're 1500 years later. But they didn't. They didn't have any effects on things that weren't true to the story. So I'm totally fine with that. The one or two things that sort of didn't work for me was the Mithril tree and the fact that it's got this Silmaril in it, and then it kind of went down into the earth and there's a Balrog and stuff. That was just so far off the truth of this real story of the Silmarils that it did irk me. I was sorely vexed by that. I know that they kind of introduced that was a legend. They spent quite a lot of time talking about how this was just one idea of a myth of a legend, but I would have liked to have been proven that it was just a legend somehow, that wasn't real. They've sort of seemed to have set that up as part of the in-story lore for this show. I know why they did it. They wanted to make it be really clear that the Mithril was the thing that was going to help save the elves. But I didn't like how overdramatic the concept of the elves fading was. Especially, I liked the line and I liked the delivery, but when Durin said about his friend drowning and not being able to throw them a lifeline, it's over the top. Like, elves don't die. They actually do not die. So I thought, and again, for dramatic purposes, for moving the story along, for increasing the kind of jeopardy of the situation, I know why they did it. I just don't think they had to do it as extremely. So I wanted to give you a little bit of background again about elves. We've gone into this a little bit before in previous episodes, but there's some really good information about this on Tolkien Gateway, which is a great website that you can go to for a whole bunch of background stuff. So basically, elves and men are both described as existing in two parts. So they have a spirit or a soul, which is called a fea, and that comes from the secret fire of Ilúvatar. You remember the great creator god. And they also have a body or a hroa, which is made out of the material of Arda. So it's exactly sort of our same concept that we have as humans. You have a soul and a body. We're pretty familiar with that kind of concept. But how it works in reality is different for each race. So the elves' fate is to live as long as Arda or the world exists. They're bound to the world and they can't leave it. They don't just die of disease. They don't die of old age. So their bodies are kind of more adapted to having the presence of their spirits in them than men are. They're much more in control of their bodies. Their bodies are more durable. They can heal from wounds that would normally be fatal to mortal men. But they can be slain and they can lose the will to live, for example, if they've got extreme grief. But when an elf dies, their fea or their spirit leaves the body, which then dies and is reabsorbed into Arda. That sounds familiar to us, I guess. But the fea is then called to the halls of Mandos. We've talked about that before, and it's judged there. And they have to wait there for a bit. And then they might be reincarnated. The fea, their spirit, might be reincarnated into a new body that's identical to their previous hroa or body. And then for the men, it's different. So a human fea or spirit is just a visitor to Arda, to the world. And when their body dies, the spirit leaves the world completely. No one knows where their spirit goes. And this sort of severance of their spirit and their body happens after quite a short time in relation to the elves. And so men aren't bound to the fate of the world as the elves are. They're sort of released from the world. And we've talked about before, it's this kind of mortality is known as the gift of men or the doom of men. And so with this whole waning of the elves thing, this fading of the elves, that it does appear in the show, like they're saying that they're just all going to die. They're literally next spring going to drop down dead. That doesn't happen. Morgoth corrupted the earth with his evil. That was also known as the marring of Arda, and that caused the waning of the elves. So the elves who chose to continue living in Middle-earth, they suffered this kind of weakening of their bodies over really long periods of time. So we're talking thousands of years. It caused their spirit to almost consume their bodies, so they kind of in the end become more like wraiths if they stay for too long. And this is what kind of led to the men becoming dominant in Middle-earth. And the elves could only avoid this by leaving Middle-earth and sailing to the Undying Lands to the west, because their bodies didn't wane or fade there. So at any time, these elves can go to the west. So they kind of didn't cover that. They made it seem like it was this big special thing that Gil-galad was granting Galadriel this amazing benefit of being sent to the west. And like any of them can go at any time, even the ones that had chosen to stay there or the ones that had never been into the west. They're just choosing not to. I think we talked before about how they love being the lords in Middle-earth and being superior to everybody else rather than being the lesser beings in Valinor. So that's a bit of background. It just made me feel like that the whole concept of overemphasizing that the elves are going to be destroyed was a bit unnecessary. I know they did it to make it more dramatic and exciting to watch, but I just don't think it was as necessary to go as far as they did. I'd love to hear from someone who didn't know the background of that stuff and just to know whether it's, you know, would it have made a difference if they had just talked about them, their strength fading, you know? I don't know. What do you think about that, Penny?
So I only have known the background really since that you've told me. But just based on that and based on, you know, my vague memories of reading the appendices when I was a kid, it struck me weird, the elf story, and I was expecting for it to be revealed to be not true. Because I was like, that doesn't seem right. I don't think elves, like, can't they just leave Middle-earth? And why are they so determined to stay in Middle-earth? Like, they didn't really sell me on their need to stay in Middle-earth. Because he did, I think at one point, Gil-galad did say, like, and we'll be forced to leave Middle-earth. And I was like, all right, leave. Like, it wasn't your country to begin with. You're an occupying army, and you're kind of jerks about it. But I also understand why they did it, but I think it was unnecessary. They very much could have just had a story like the elves, you know, the earth has been corrupted by Morgoth, and the elves draw our power from it, and so we're less powerful, and so we want to create these rings to, you know, get us back to our old levels of power. That would have made sense to me, and it would have been a lust for power story that Tolkien likes, right? Like he likes to talk about that, and more subtle than a we need to save our race from, you know, death. Yeah. I think maybe it was like they thought it would be too hard for people to understand since it's a show that is geared for families and not just adults. I don't know.
Yeah, it could be. It does. I mean, it simplifies it, doesn't it? It's almost sort of like an exaggeration of it. Again, the theme is there. The correct theme is there. All the ideas come from the lore. It's actually, you know, apart from the Silmaril tree, but all of the rest of it does match. So,
except the Mithril, like glowing and having magical properties, because like Mithril exists in the Lord of the Rings movies. Like Frodo has that Mithril shirt of armor, and it's just lightweight strong metal. There's no like magic glowing,
there's nothing mystical about it. And and they did use Mithril in the making of the three rings, particularly in Galadriel's one, but it's not because it's can save their lives. So they've kind of, that's a bit of license, I think. And, you know, it makes a really good visual effect. You remember that moment when Durin throws the piece of Mithril across the table
and it lands heals next the leaf?
That? Yeah. That was OTT.
That was cool.
But it looked cool.
It looked really cool.
Yeah. The only other little nitpick I have is just a little bit some of the dialogue. So I thought that a lot of the dialogue was really great. I loved all of the dialogue with Arondir and Bronwyn. I loved the dialogue with Galadriel and Theo. I thought that they blended that perfectly to be true to each of their characters and how they would each speak. I thought that some of the Numenorean stuff was a little stilted. Just a couple of the scenes with Miriel and Elendil, I thought their chemistry is great and the acting was fine, but it didn't seem to sort of match up with the level of quality that we had with the elves and particularly with the dwarves as well. All the dialogue with the dwarves I thought was outstanding.
Every second of the dwarves on screen was perfection.
Yeah. And when we had an episode where they weren't on screen, it was a little bit disappointing. Hey, I missed them.
Yeah, it was like, hey, what's Tisa up to? She's going to make some trouble.
Yeah. Well, and look, that merges quite well into my next point, which is our favourite characters. And mine was definitely anything to do with Deesa, Durin, and Elrond, or any combo of those three.
Yeah. They're wonderful together. I mean, who couldn't love them? Deesa and Durin's marriage is like, that's the marriage I want if I ever get married. The way they love and support and challenge each other, it's beautiful.
Yeah, it seems like such an equal relationship, doesn't it? They're sort of as fierce as each other, but they can be tender. They are hugely loyal to each other, and they share this kind of ambition as well, which we got to see in the later episodes of you know, when they're talking about ruling together. I think it was just beautiful to watch, and really loved how they sort of introduced them in that comical way. You know, that first episode that we see them, they were kind of funny and silly, and there was that whole, you know, rock-breaking challenge with Elrond and everything. But they deepened the characters pretty quickly and very well, I thought. Lots of layers to it, lots of complexity. And just amazing on screen. I've seen a couple of interviews of the different cast members, and they often, of course, interview the actors who played Durin and Deesa together, and sometimes the actor with Elrond as well. And they are just hilarious. They've just got great chemistry on and off screen. So I thought it was beautiful.
I've started following that actress's Instagram page.
Oh, cool.
And she was having just a blast at whatever was the last fashion week, and wearing these absolutely amazing outfits. And she had her hair in this amazing style where she had this like gold down the part. And I just fell more in love with her watching her like out of dwarf costume. I was like, oh, she's amazing in real life too. Like,
yeah, her style is beautiful, isn't it? She's just got the most amazing fashion sense, and just this confidence and glow about her that is just so inspirational. I absolutely love it. Yeah. I loved that the friendship between Durin and Elrond, you know, the way that they sort of verbally sparred with each other, but you could tell that there was this deep love between them as well. I thought that was beautiful, and I could just watch, like, I could watch the Durin and Elrond show, you know, if they did a spin-off and just went off into the woods together. It would be just awesome.
I was thinking I would love to see how they met and became friends to begin with, because they are very different people.
And yeah.
Where was Durin out for a hunt? And he came across Elrond, you know, reading one of his books in a tree. How did they meet?
Yeah.
Was it a diplomatic mission? Who knows?
Exactly. It would be so good to know that. And because at this point in the story, you know, there's supposed to be this quite good relationship between the elves of Eregion and the dwarves of Khazad Dûm. In fact, Eregion was founded and built so close to Khazad Dûm just because of that. They wanted to have this trade and this relationship. And so it'd be really cool to see how they did meet. But they portrayed it so beautifully on screen. I thought it was really, really well done.
Yeah, there's a lot of tenderness there. And that's another relationship that felt very lived in. Even from the first moment, Durin's anger, you could tell when he first saw Elrond again, was a love-based anger. He was hurt, like really, really hurt by his friend. And it felt like he had been for many years. There was a gravity to it.
Yeah, it was simmering. He was there for 20 years thinking about how his friend had let him down, and it was beautifully portrayed. I did love that. I also adored Arondir. I just loved him. He was so beautiful to watch. It was great to see an elf much more grounded and part of the land and kind of grimy. You know, we did get used to in The Lord of the Rings seeing the elves, even Legolas, who was out and about fighting, he never got a speck of dust on him. It's like so beautifully groomed. But
that's true. And most of the other elves we see are always like in, you know, these sparkly, long flowing gowns and are in these peaceful forests or in their Art Deco homes. But yeah, Arondir is out in the world.
He is. You know, he's grimy. He's a fighter. His action scenes were some of my favorite moments in the whole show. The scene where they're in the tunnels and he's attacking the orcs with the chain and doing those big aerial kind of jumps over them. Oh, I could just watch that again and again. And when he caught the arrow and then fired it back again, just amazing. Absolutely loved it. I thought he and Bronwyn were great together. I really liked their chemistry. It was so kind of yearning and forbidden and but just beautifully handled. And he was so shy
about it.
Yeah, it was so, so sweet.
So shy. I just, in the rewatch, I saw the scene that I did today. I saw the scene where he basically proposes to her.
Yeah.
It's before the battle.
He's like, let's go and have a garden. When this is all over, it's going to be you and me.
We'll get a house. It'll be great. And I was like, that's really beautiful. And like, he knows that there's, you know, everyone's going to hate them. But I guess the danger that they're facing and the danger he already faced in Adar's prison was enough to push him past that and to be like, I just want to be with the person I love.
Yeah, I am really fascinated to see where they go with that whole civilization, because off they go to the Bay of Palagir or wherever they've gone. And we didn't really see anything else of them in that finale of what's going to happen to them. So I will be interested to see how they bring them back into the main kind of story of what happens next. That's going to be cool. I want to talk a moment about Isildur. We talked already a little bit about his relationship with Elendil. It was interesting how they portrayed Isildur. Just, you know, for those of us who know the story, like, you know, we kind of go with the idea that most people from who are watching this show and listening to us probably have seen the Peter Jackson films. So we know that Isildur features in the prologue of those, and we sort of know where he kind of ends up, I guess. I won't say anything more in case people haven't, but I wonder with this building of Isildur's character, because let's face it, he's a little bit annoying, right? he doesn't have that much consideration for other people. He acted really irrationally on the boat trying to get himself out of the Navy, but he ended up getting his two friends kicked out as well. He's that really sort of inconsiderate grabbing of the apple, taking two bites, giving his horse only one bite and then throwing it off the side of the boat was just, he just seems like,
spoiled, you know, and then, entitled.
Yeah, spoiled, not wanting to listen to his dad until that sort of very kind of last scene when they're talking about the horse. I wonder whether they're setting him up to be like that or that we're going to see him grow to, because Isildur in the books, you know, he does a lot of really great stuff before he does, you know, the thing at the end that isn't as great. Mm-hmm. He ends up doing some really, really good, important stuff. And so I really want to see them build, hopefully in the next season, him up to be more of a sympathetic and believable and heroic character, because that is what he becomes. I'm just not quite sure why they're going already with this kind of petulant teenager thing, but I'm hoping he's got a good arc that shows that.
Now he is missing, right? He's missing, presumed dead on the field of battle. He is stuck in Mordor. We know he's alive because he shows up later in the story, but he's in Mordor. He's trapped somewhere. Is he someone's prisoner? I think he's going to have a lot of growth to go through getting himself out of there.
Yeah. And I think, you know, we've got Beric obviously galloping off to go and find him. I've been reading recently The Unfinished Tales, which is a collection of writings put together by Tolkien's son, Christopher Tolkien, where he collected a whole bunch of writings and journal entries and letters and all kinds of background scribblings and notes from Tolkien that lend more kind of weight and more background to the stories that we know. It's a really interesting book to just kind of dip in and out of different chapters. But there is a thing in there about the Numenoreans and their horses. So I thought I'd just read it out.
Oh, cool.
This kind of shows you that it was really cool. It lends a little bit more weight to the scene with Isildur and Elendil talking about the horses and how they bond with their riders. So it's pretty cool. It says, "In Numenor, all journeyed from place to place on horseback, for in riding, the Numenoreans, both men and women, took delight, and all the people of the land loved horses, treating them honourably and housing them nobly. They were trained to hear and answer calls from a great distance, and it is said in old tales that where there was great love between men and women and their favourite steeds, they could be summoned at need by thought alone." That's pretty cool, right?
So here's my question. Is Beric the ancestor of Shadowfax?
Oh, I don't know. I'm just trying to think.
Right? If he's like a magical horse, and Shadowfax is a magical horse, where did he come from?
I don't know where ShadowFax came from. That's a good point. I have to look that up. It doesn't sort of say anything necessarily about them being magical in Numenor, but just that the bond was so great. And, you know, this kind of shows maybe that's why Beric ran off, is that actually could Isildur have called, either intentionally or unintentionally, he's wounded, he's lying there.
I think that whole time, because Elendil was trying to calm Beric, and Valandil, Isildur's friend, was like, he's been like this, like nobody can calm him. I think the whole time Beric was like, no, Isildur's alive, like I'm not getting on that boat. And so he was fighting and fighting and fighting, and then Elendil just let him go. Because I think Isildur's probably, if he called for Beric, that's one thing, but he's probably unconscious. Even so, Beric was like, he's alive, I'm not leaving.
Yeah. That's pretty cool, isn't it? I love, that's one of the great things I love about dipping in and out of the books, is to find these little background pieces. And of course, they don't have the license to the Unfinished Tales or the Silmarillion or anything else apart from Lord of the Rings and the appendices. But there are pieces of information in there that they can use to build on. So they can't directly talk about any scenes or anything specific, but that piece of information about them being bonded to their horse, they can use that as part of the background of these Numenoreans. So I do really like that, and I enjoy it.
It's really cool.
What about other characters? Is there anybody else that stood out for you or that you wanted to talk about?
I think Adar is a fascinating character. I mean, obviously he's not a favorite in terms of like someone I like, but the story of someone who was, whether voluntarily or not, made twisted and turned into an agent of Morgoth, who seems to legitimately hate Sauron and oppose Sauron, who has, you know, fulfilled this plan that everyone on Middle-earth thought was Sauron's plan, and that Sauron was the leader. It's been Adar, because Sauron's been off doing his Halbrand thing. And so he's a strong, powerful leader, and he has this whole, like, freedom of my people cause that's actually pretty sympathetic, right? Like, I don't think the way to get a land for your people is to explode a volcano and kill everyone, but wanting a place where the orcs can live in peace is a noble ambition. And I, you know, he was willing to do all this violence to humans, but I can kind of understand where he's coming from a little bit. I think he's really layered, and I think I really want to see in season two some information about what may have transpired between him and Sauron in the past.
Yeah, that'd be great to see, because it's clear when you go back and look at it, knowing for certain that Halbrand is Sauron, that scene between them when he says, "Do you remember me?" So there's a couple of different options. He could be saying, "No, I don't," because, Sauron / Halbrand has got this, taken a form that Adar doesn't recognize, or it could be that he does recognize that it's him, but he just doesn't want to acknowledge it, either in front of Galadriel or just in general, that he doesn't want to acknowledge it. So it will be interesting to see if they touch on that and see, because, Sauron's now gone back to Mordor. He's going to bang into Adar and the orcs and obviously want to be the big boss again. So it will be really cool to see. I can't wait for a scene between those two again. It's going to be great.
When I was looking, Halbrand says after the battle, when he's injured in that ridiculous scene where he then gets on a horse and gallops, he says, "I will not abandon these lands to burn." And he says to Galadriel, and neither will you. And I really believed him about that. Like, I don't think that he would have ever, maybe not ever, but he would have, used the key and unleashed Mount Doom like that, because he was trying to supposedly heal Middle Earth and bring order. And that was chaotic and destructive. I think he's going to oppose Adar, but I think he might think he's still trying to be the good guy in season two.
Yeah, again, I wonder how much they're condensing the timeline again with that, because, you know, we've seen all this stuff about him wanting to help and to heal, and I've heard lots of differing opinions on Sauron and all over the internet and on different podcasts and things. You know, some people thought it was really obvious that Halbrand was Sauron. Some people thought it really wasn't, had no clue. Other people thought he's definitely penitent and wants to heal Middle-earth, and he's being sincere when he says to Galadriel, your goodness can help me and help Middle-earth. Other people were like, no, he's just the biggest trickster ever, so he's pure evil. But I did have a little bit, again, to read about Sauron along those lines, because I do feel like that they are perhaps condensing it to show us his kind of, not necessarily repentant, but his side that wants to help and to rehabilitate Middle-earth, and then they're going to go towards further and further towards the darkness. So there's a section in the Unfinished Tales which says, Sauron endeavoured to keep distinct his two sides, enemy and tempter. When he came among the Noldor, he adopted a specious fair form, a kind of simulated anticipation of the later Istari, and a fair name, Artano, Highsmith, or Aulendil, meaning one who is devoted to the service of the Valar Aule. The note goes on to say that Galadriel was not deceived, saying that this Aulendil was not in the train of Aule and Valinor. But this is not decisive, since Aule existed before the building of Arda, and the probability is in fact that Sauron was one of the Aulean Maia, corrupted before Arda began by Melkor. In a letter written in September 1954, my father said, so this is Christopher Tolkien writing, my father Tolkien said, at the beginning of the Second Age, Sauron was still beautiful to look at, or could still assume a beautiful visible shape, and was not indeed wholly evil. Not unless all reformers who want to hurry up with reconstruction and reorganization are wholly evil, even before pride and the lust to exert their will eat them up. The particular branch of the High Elves concerned, the Noldor or Lore Masters, were always vulnerable on the side of science and technology, as we should call it. They wanted to have the knowledge that Sauron genuinely had, and those of Eregion refused the warnings of Gil-galad and Elrond. The particular desire of the Eregion elves, an allegory, if you like, of the love of machinery and technical devices, is also symbolized by their special friendship with the dwarves of Moria. So there's a couple of things in there. Pretty much confirming that Sauron is not wholly evil, that he did want to have this kind of reorganization. And then also touches on the fact that Gil-galad and Elrond didn't trust him, and it was basically just Celebrimbor who kind of fell for his charms. So I do like that. I think they've got the tone of him right, mm-hmm. where it's difficult to tell whether he's being tricksy or whether he really does believe that. And I like that, because maybe he doesn't even know at this point.
Yeah. I mean, and a lot of, you know, actors who play villains always say, nobody thinks they're the bad guy. Yeah. I don't know if the same thing is true for non-human, like, super beings, like Sauron, like the Astari. But he thinks he's going to do good. He thinks he has good intentions. And he knows and recognizes evil in the past. I like to believe that there's no such thing as a 100% evil human. I spent a lot of time today wondering if I could apply that to, you know, the various races of Middle-earth. But I would like to believe that 100% evil does not exist. So yeah, I think there's some good
certainly
in him.
Yeah, and certainly Tolkien was of that perspective. He was a Catholic, and he believed that everybody was redeemable, whether they chose that path of redemption, but everybody had the capacity to repent and to go choose a different path. I like what you say about bad guys not knowing they're bad guys or believing that they're doing good. I think it makes them more complex characters and more interesting. It's the old Thanos thing, isn't it, from the Marvel yeah. universe, where he felt that he was saving and helping the Earth by getting rid of 50% of the population. That was his mission, and he didn't think he was the bad guy. So yeah, it's a cool concept. I wanted to talk a little bit about Galadriel.
Yeah,
she's
a character.
Yeah, she's, you know, they've chosen to, I guess, focus this first season on her in terms of being the main, I guess, the main character a lot of ways in terms of moving this story along, or that a lot of it's told from her perspective.
Yeah.
I did really like having the chance to look back over the season as a whole with Galadriel. I've seen a lot of criticisms of her character. Again, I think overall they got it right. it was nice to have the perspective of the whole season, and especially the scenes with her and Theo, to kind of humanize her a little bit more, because there were times there where she was really annoying and really so single-minded and, you know, so intense with her thoughts and her actions. You know, some people have said that they didn't think she would ever have been tempted by this offer of power from Sauron. I disagree. I think it's there in the writings. I've got another little reading for you guys.
Yeah, I agree.
From the Unfinished Tales. She's just, she's much more complex than most people. If you've read The Lord of the Rings and you've seen the movies and you haven't read anything else, it is a fairly shallow or one-sided version of Galadriel that we get, beautifully portrayed by Cate Blanchett. The power and the majesty and the wisdom and the age is amazingly portrayed. But that's Galadriel after having been there for thousands of years, a lot of that time in sort of seclusion. But we're getting to see the younger Galadriel
and
the things.
Having already gone through this temptation. So she's learned from this.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah, and we see the echo of that when she's tempted by the ring, when Frodo has it. That's one of the reasons I think it's so true to her character. There's a section here that says, it's got a good description. So there's the history of Galadriel and Celeborn, which is really interesting reading. There's a wee section here to describe Galadriel. I'll just read part of it. She was strong of body, mind, and will, a match for both the Loremasters and the athletes of the Eldar in the days of their youth. Even among the Eldar, she was accounted beautiful, and her hair was held a marvel unmatched. It was golden like the hair of her father and her foremother, Indus, but richer and more radiant, for its gold was touched by some memory of the star-like silver of her mother. And the Eldar said that the light of the two trees, Lorelin and Telperion, had been snared in her tresses. Many thought that the saying first gave to Feanor the thought of imprisoning and blending the light of the trees that later took shape in his hands as the Silmarils. For Feanor beheld the hair of Galadriel with wonder and delight. He begged three times for a tress, but Galadriel would not give him even one hair. These two kinfolk, the greatest of the Eldar of Valinor, were unfriends forever. Galadriel was born in the bliss of Valinor, but it was not long in the reckoning of the blessed realm before that was dimmed, and thereafter she had no peace within. For in that testing time amid the strife of the Noldor, she was drawn this way and that. She was proud, strong, and self-willed, as were all the descendants of Finwë save Finarfin, and like her brother Finrod, of all her kin, the nearest to her heart, she had dreams of far lands and dominions that might be her own to order as she would without tutelage. So that tells me she did want to rule in Middle-earth. She did want some power and to rule over people and to have a place of her own. I think that lends weight really well to the fact that she was tempted by Sauron's kind of offer and later by the ring. I think her sort of longevity and her strength was really believable when she was so feisty with the Numenoreans and so single-minded. And when she first got there and she's like, this is all we have to do. She sort of doesn't have time to play around. She's been on this mission this whole time and she really needs to kind of move things along. I saw some criticism that she was ever charmed by Halbrand at all, because in the story they say that she was suspicious of him from the start. But again, they condensed the storyline and they sort of managed to show that initial redemption, his desire for redemption before he turned back to darkness. And I think Galadriel caught him at that time. Mm-hmm. You know, but again, he says, I never lied to you. She just basically made assumptions of who he was and what he stood for. The other little thing that I do love from that little reading there was it makes it even more significant later when you realize that she gives Gimli three of her, the strands of her hair, of how special she felt he was, and that she actually would give that up when she had been, you know, asked by one of the most powerful elves previously and said no. I thought that was really a really cool little
beautiful
note there. She's also, I thought the casting was interesting. In the story, she's actually older than Celebrimbor. So I thought the age that they cast Celebrimbor was interesting, and the age that they cast her. Of course, elves live for thousands and thousands of years or forever. So a couple of hundred years here and there probably doesn't make very much difference. But as humans, we're used to seeing someone and assuming that they are a certain number of years or a certain generation older than the others. Feanor was Galadriel's uncle, but was actually Celebrimbor's grandfather. She's even older than Gil-galad, He was her brother's grandson, which makes her Gilgalad's great aunt. It's kind of interesting. She's shown as this feisty young thing, and I think it works for the purposes of the story, especially since he's, you know, he's the king. She has to kind of pay heed to that. But I wasn't so keen on Celebrimbor being kind of like the bumbling uncle.
Yeah, you know, I was about to say he's like somebody's uncle.
Because he's ancient as well, you know, and he's wise and he's supposed to be kind and gentle, but that doesn't have to make him a fool.
He reminded me more of Bilbo than he did of any other elf within all of the Middle Earth stories. He didn't seem particularly connected to the world around him the way elves always have that coolness that like makes you think that they're part tree or something, that they just are connected to the earth. But he seems like a human. He just seems like a dude.
Yeah, that's one of the reasons why I thought it would have been nicer to have a longer extended period of him and Halbrand working together, where it just seemed like, you know, he's just amazing smith. You know, he's a grandson of Feanor. He's got all this skill, and Halbrand just kind of comes in and goes, oh, we have all manner of different kind of, you know, what does he say? Something about metals are rare as hen's teeth where I'm from. And have you thought about mixing them together? Oh, you know, like it just felt a little bit too...
It was quick.
It was delicious to watch, but it was a bit quick and a bit contrived. So it would have been nicer to see that take place over longer. And I think it would have given more gravity to Celebrimbor and his already wisdom, you know, and knowledge that he had already.
Yeah.
But yeah, again, that's kind of a little bit nitpicky. I thought overall it was still great. And it will be really interesting to see, you know, talking about Galadriel, whether they continue to have her sort of central to the story over the next few seasons, because I don't know that they would have to for storytelling purposes. It depends on what they cover with each season. You know, are we going to focus more on Isildur and Elendil, or are we going to focus more on what's happening back in Numenor, or are we, you know, how much are we going to see of the dwarves? How much are we going to see of the Harfoots? It's going to be really interesting to see.
Yeah, especially the Harfoots. Now that Nori and the Stranger have left them behind, it's like, is there going to be any reason to go back to see them again? Until the end when, you know, they have a big party?
Yeah, it's going to be, I can't wait to see. It's going to be really cool.
We'll see.
And we just have to let it all wash over us. But yeah, we're in for the long haul. We're talking four more seasons. And if they take 2 years to do each one, then, you know. It's going to be 2030 before we see this finale out. So let's be patient. And yeah, lots of stuff to dig into in the meantime, if you do want to get into stuff.
There's no rush. If you're out there and you're going to do a rewatch of the show, take your time.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you could just like watch one episode every couple of months and you'll probably be good.
It's true. And then you have plenty of time to listen to our podcast, so that's good.
Totally. Yeah, because some of those episodes ran pretty long, so there you go. Any other favorite characters or scenes, anything that else that stood out to you?
I mean, there's so many scenes that I loved. As ridiculous as it was, I really enjoyed the after the volcano orange cloud. It was just really, it was kind of cool to see. And I'm a sucker for good costumes, and all of the costumes were beautiful, but especially Galadriel's gown in the last episode.
Oh, the green one?
I was like, why isn't Amazon already selling this?
Yeah.
Like, they have a fashion section on Amazon Prime. Like, sell that dress. But yeah, it was so beautiful. And the Numenorean armor. Oh, so beautiful.
Gorgeous. I loved how they was almost like a blend of the kind of Gondor and Rohan. You know, the helmets had that long tress kind of tail to it, which we see later with the Rohans. But the kind of color and texture of it was a bit more Gondorian.
Gondor.
I thought that was beautiful as well. There's a page that I follow on Facebook, which is Lord of the Rings costuming and cosplay or something like that.
Oh, I got to follow that.
And it's amazing just seeing what people do and what they come up with. And there was one I saw where a woman made Galadriel's armor from the final episodes there, and incredible detail and just how she actually formed this out of foam and all these different kinds of materials. And yeah, it's incredible the time and skill that people put into those things. But yeah, I would have thought it would be a pretty good line to have some official cosplay merchandise as well from Amazon.
Yeah,
I think people would be into that.
Come on, Amazon, you're a giant, but you're letting me down.
Yeah. Awesome. All right. Anything else?
I wish I were more educated about music, because I feel like there's a lot to be said about the music on the show, and I am just not qualified to do it. But I have been very much enjoying the music and hearing from other people that it's also great for them.
Yeah, one of the things that I love about the music is that I didn't notice it much. And that sounds weird, but if you notice there being too much or too little or it not sitting right, then it's not a good thing. If you don't notice it much and it just lends credence and power and weight to the story and each scene that you're doing, then that's a great thing. And I think Bea McCreary did an incredible job with the music in this. There was an interview with him recently on theonering.net, which is really cool to listen to as well. So you can go and have a wee look at that. Yeah, I had no problem with the music at all. I thought it was beautiful. And I think keeping some of the sort of tone and feel of Howard Shore's original score from The Lord of the Rings, but also being a little bit different again, was really well done. I think he got that balance really, really perfect. All right, so we are going to take a short break and we're going to come back for some news and some listener feedback, so stay with us. Okay, we're back and we have a couple of pieces of news. I did scour the internet to try and find any information on the filming. We know that it started for season two, but there isn't anything new since we last recorded, obviously keeping pretty hush-hush with all of that. But we did have a couple of quite interesting articles here. The first one is from CBR.com and it says, "For many fans, there was legitimate hype going into The Lord of the Rings of Power. They were excited to see what the Amazon series would offer. However, that wasn't everyone's attitude. A portion of the fan base approached The Rings of Power with nothing but skepticism. Most of the skeptical fans were upset that the series was reportedly playing fast and loose with some of Tolkien's lore. While those fans' complaints were justified on some fronts, their initial skepticism hindered their ability to enjoy The Rings of Power at all. That's why some reviews of The Rings of Power weren't very good. The thing is, recent numbers have shown that a lot of the negative press was put out by a small, vocal group of narrow-minded fans. The reason that some fans didn't like the series was due to lore-based decisions. Lord of the Rings fans take Tolkien's material very seriously, so when The Rings of Power started making some changes to canon, like the new origin of Mithril, it didn't vibe with some fans, including me. On the flip side of the criticism, many fans really did like The Lord of the Rings of Power. Basically, the series reviews matched the pre-release sentiments. Those who wanted to like The Rings of Power liked it, but those who were skeptical didn't like it because they never gave it a chance. It's interesting to note, however, that there were a lot more fans who liked the series than disliked it. During the series run, Parrot Analytics found that the audience demand was 34.5 times the demand of the average TV series in the United States. Likewise, Nielsen's ratings show an impressive 988 million minutes of viewing time in the US during the week of September 12 to 18. All of this information together makes it clear there were a few vocal viewers who really didn't like the series, while the majority of viewers thought it was pretty good. Another bit of proof is that a chart from IMDb reflecting user ratings for the series, most of the reviews were either 1 or 10 stars, with very little ratings in the middle. Again, that chart, combined with negative comments, seems to show that a lot of viewers gave The Rings of Power negative reviews based on its non-adherence to the Tolkien material, not on its own merit. Hopefully, viewers will be a little more open-minded in season 2.
That's really interesting. That 34.5 times the average TV series is a just staggering number.
It's mind-blowing, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, there's been I have also read that Amazon has been pretty quiet about ratings or viewings in general. I'm not even sure how they measure it, mm-hmm. but it's interesting that we get two different kind of
numbers there from different organizations who rate it or track the numbers. But yeah, that whole, the loud vocal minority is really key. And that's what we saw obviously from the beginning as well, that, you know, people who were review bombing on Rotten Tomatoes and everything. It was just a bunch of really noisy people, but clearly there are millions and millions and millions of people who did watch it and not get too annoyed by it. So that's good.
That is good. From Esquire.com, this is just a piece of a much larger article. J.R.R. Tolkien's source material is narratively thin, consisting largely of battles and successions. Rings of Power showrunners have grafted connected tissue onto this sparse scaffolding, shading in the thoughts, feelings, and choices that propel familiar characters to each predetermined plot point. We know where these characters are going, but if there's one thing Tolkienites understand, it's that it's the journey that shapes and changes us, not the destination. Where Tolkien gave us only the destination, Rings of Power backfills the journey. Take Lord Elrond, for example. How did he become such a legendary statesman, able to build consensus between mortal and immortal races? Rings of Power imagines his years as a rookie diplomat, building out a formative and often touching friendship with the dwarven Prince Durin the Fourth. As Strange New Worlds accomplishes with Spock, suddenly Elrond's canonical future makes more sense. To be clear, the Star Trek and Lord of the Rings fandoms are not without their own share of bad behavior, and for some fans, even simply enlarging the canon is still a bridge too far. But Gandalf wasn't in Middle-earth during the Second Age, these persnickety purists argue, taking aim at the all-too-likely theory that Rings of Power's mysterious stranger is, in fact, the notorious wizard Gandalf. Sure, Gandalf the Grey had yet to arrive in Middle-earth during the Second Age, setting encompassed by Rings of Power, but during this timeline, he was knocking around the continent by other names in other forms. Where canon-obsessed fans might see a limitation, any good storyteller would see a tantalizing mystery. Tolkien himself often amended and expanded his own work, so why shouldn't Rings of Power take some creative liberties, especially with the author's gray areas? Isn't it more fun to think about what could be true rather than what must be true?
I like that. I like the kind of open-mindedness of it and that concept of leaving yourself open to exploring mysteries. It's a great article. And for those of you who are Star Trek fans as well, I highly recommend it. We'll put the link in the show notes because it really does go into depth about both the Star Trek kind of world and the Tolkien world. So it's pretty cool. I'm a fan of both, so I really enjoyed it.
I haven't watched Strange New Worlds yet, but that's coming up in my list.
Neither have I. We're really behind. There's Discovery and there's Picard and there's Strange New Worlds, and yeah, I've heard that Strange New Worlds is one of the better of the three, so definitely keen to dive into that one. All right, so we got some good listener feedback as well this week from people wanting to give us their thoughts on the season as a whole. Do you want to get started with our comment from Facebook?
Sure. Jody Langridge wrote in to say, "I'm very much looking forward to hearing your recap of the season, as I have enjoyed the podcast a lot." Thank you. "I have never read the books or watched any of the movies, so I watched this series without any expectations. There was so much going on, a lot of locations and names that are sometimes hard to follow. Having the podcast every week was just a wonderful help with remembering how everyone fit into the storyline. So thank you all for doing such a great job. Onwin and Penny, your passion for this world is just a joy to listen to." Well, I could read this comment all day. Thank you so much, Jody. "Overall, I enjoyed the season very much, and it was over too soon. It was just beautiful to watch, and I hope that continues for the next season after the filming location change." Yes, we're worried about that, too. Mm-hmm. "It was great having all the red herrings throughout, keeping us all guessing as to who was the bad guy. I think my favorite character at this point is Durin, and any scene he is in with any other character, especially his scenes with Elrond. I am not too emotionally invested in any of the others yet. Maybe after another season that might happen. I would like to see a softer side of Galadriel. She is always so stern and serious. Relax, gal. Maybe get a massage. Thanks again, and looking forward to hearing other listener feedback on the season." Little elf emoji.
Oh, thanks.
Thanks so much, Jodie. That's brilliant. I loved your message. Thank you. Appreciate it. And we both agree about Durin and Elronda for sure.
Adorable.
Now we got a fantastic email from Jordan. Jordan says, "Hi, Anwen and Penny. We really, really wanted to love this show as a family of Tolkien and Lord of the Rings fans. However, we couldn't focus on the main story as the show was so poorly done. I don't feel like sugarcoating anything, so these are my honest opinions summed up. Please note that I am not too fussed on the lore of the Tolkien universe. This is more about the actual show than accurate lore. What I enjoyed. New Tolkien content is always a good thing. One thing that pulled me through the show was the fact that it was tied to the Tolkien universe. Finding out more about Mithril was pretty cool. The Stranger and his character development was interesting. Eddar was probably the best character, a really enjoyable villain. And some of the scenery was spectacular. What I didn't enjoy. The writing was by far the worst aspect of the show. The half-wit plotline was generally boring, and when it was exciting, it was always centred around the Stranger. The dialogue was stilted. Poor Galadriel deserved more consistent characterisation and the ability to not contradict herself every 10 seconds. I felt the plotlines were really predictable. I guessed about half of what eventually unfolded. The pacing was inconsistent, especially when it came to the half-wits. We found it so hard to stay engaged with that plotline because very little actually happened. Use of plot armour, especially Bronwyn and her elf friend Arondir. She'd been impaled, then had her wound cauterised, and in the next scene she looked clean, perfectly healthy and able-bodied. In the episode where the orcs attack the villagers, the army of Numenor arrives right on time to save the villagers. There was no communication between them. The Sauron reveal went from 0 to 100 very quickly. A few scattered hints in episodes 1 through 7, then in episode 8 you get hit on the head with all these major clues. In the first few episodes I didn't want to believe it was Halbrand because I found it a bit ridiculous that he could be Sauron. It could have been worse though. The creation of Mount Doom was disappointing. I felt the ancient broken sword had so much potential. It could have done anything, been used by anyone. To have it unlock a lake that channeled into a dormant volcano was pretty underwhelming. The orcs built many channels so the water could flow into the volcano, but what if they didn't? Would the water just fall into the valley and do nothing? For a show with a $1 billion budget, the experience was rather mundane. The bad writing was much more funny than the sad attempts at humour throughout the show. There were many other instances of poor writing, but the above is what I can remember off the top of my head. We really wanted to enjoy Rings of Power as a family, but it was very hard to watch at points, and the most epic battle was staying the distance to watch each episode in one sitting. Overall, I would give this show around 4 out of 10 as it had so much potential, but they failed to make it a good project. Don't let me deter you from watching Rings of Power if you haven't already, as everyone will experience different levels of enjoyment. Best regards, Jordan, age 14. Thanks so much, Jordan. And first off, what a beautifully written email. I absolutely love that you have put so much thought and time into sending your thoughts in. And for a 14-year-old, that is some really gorgeous writing. So thank you for that. And I love your honesty. We don't want to just hear all of the people who raved and loved it. We want to hear some of the criticisms too. So I appreciate that. And some of the things that you've pointed out, I think we've already discussed here today in terms of some of the sort of the dialogue being stilted and some of the pacing and things like that as well. I guess my only kind of justification that I would want to argue a point with you is Bronwyn, I did agree that she was healthy really quickly, but again, it was those magical elven seeds. We might have to blame it on that in terms of how she healed so quickly. What do you think, Penny?
I still don't know how they all got so clean. ash is very hard to clean. Like it's really difficult to get off of your skin and your hair. I really appreciate Jordan's point of view. And as you said, the letter writing is fantastic. The language is really great. I think it's just that different types of things matter more to me as a viewer than matter to Jordan. Like, I am much more into the visuals than I am the words. So I can get very swept up in that. But if, you know, the stilted dialogue was something you couldn't ignore, it would really bother me. I get
exactly.
It.
It's harder to get past for sure for some people. Absolutely. And I think the fact that his letter was so well written does show me that words are really important to Jordan. And so that was obviously more important than some of the visuals and some of the lore. So we really appreciate your feedback. Thanks so much, Jordan.
I hope you'll give season 2 a try and come back to the podcast and you can write in and tell us what's wrong.
Yeah. And maybe, look, you know, some of those things might work themselves out. So I'll be really keen to hear if you do give the rest of the seasons a try. And I'm glad you managed to stick it out to kind of see the arc of the whole season. So write in again and we'll see what you think.
Great. We got a few voicemails, so I will start playing them.
Hi, I know this is over. This is Karen. Just after episode 6, I had to say that I was most amazed that in Steve's Live Steve that he was not as overly blown away as I was with the mountain volcano goes boom. I mean, I was like standing up going, holy, many bad words. Just I could not believe, because my first thought was like, oh my God, they're going to flood the village. They're going to flood the whole valley. And I was like, oh, how are they going to escape that? And then suddenly it's like going under them. And I'm like, wait a second. And when it goes under the mountain, goes into the mountain and it's hitting the lava, I was just like, holy shit. And I was like, really kind of glad I was, for one, I was glad my daughter was, I think, already asleep when I was watching this, so she didn't hear me swear, but then pissed that I had no one to share this with. So again, I am so happy for these podcasts, and I hope that you listen to this belated recording of me, because I just had to share like how just freaking blown away I was by that. I was not expecting that at all. I could not believe that was the end game. So yeah, wild. All right, bye.
We have another voicemail from Karen that is more of a all season review.
Hi, Penny and Onwin. It's Karen. I really enjoyed this. I know you guys are doing a recap. I just finished the last episode. Just loved the way they pulled it together, the fake out. And I was just like, no, that's not Sauron. And then Paul Bryan's up in there giving them all the really good advice. And I'm like, wait a second. And then, of course, everything works out. But I don't know. I wanted to say that I've really enjoyed this as someone who, you know, read not the Silmarillion, but the other books, got really, really into Peter Jackson's Lord of the Rings. I really felt like this was very faithful. I mean, you know, the elves felt like elves, the dwarves felt like dwarves. They were just, yeah, that's exactly what I expected. I know you guys were talking last week about Galadriel giving advice to Theo. And I was like, yeah, that's what an elf would say. You know, it wouldn't be all comforting, like, oh, maybe they're still alive. Just, you know, give you some vaguely poetic thing about, oh, well, we can't worry about what is unknown, because that's such an elf thing to say. So, like, I totally get that. I also wanted to say from the last episode, I think, or the next last episode, I agree, I think, with you guys' theory about the Harfoots being very, life is very black and white for them. There's not a lot of gray, and that's why they kind of go back and forth with a stranger. And that seems to make a lot of sense. Nori needs to, like, just, you know, keep the faith, as it were. And one last thing, Penny said something last week, like, oh, what happens in Mordor? There's no sun. There can't be any plants or animals. What are they going to eat? And of course, my brain instantly went, well, boys, I guess meat is back on the menu. So I had to say that. I was like, I hope somebody, I don't know if anybody else had that same reaction. That's exactly where my brain went. Despite the fact that I don't think they actually have restaurants in Mordor, so they wouldn't know what a menu is. But it's just such a great line, and I love it, and I don't care that it doesn't really work. But like I was saying, I very much enjoyed this whole show. I'm not the most critical viewer in the world. I know this. I just like a lot of stuff. But if I continue to like it afterwards, I know it actually is good. So I kind of want to go back again at some point and watch it again and see what I miss. I'll probably just wait until they're about to release season 2, because there's way too many other things I have to watch. But anyway, I've really been enjoying your podcast. It's really been helpful for me to feel like I have someone to quote unquote talk about this with. So yay. I'm going to stop there.
Bye, Karen. Thank you so much for calling in. And I can't wait for your feedback when we're in season two, 2 years from now.
Yeah, fantastic. Thanks so much, Karen. I really love your – it's not like the live, Steve, but it's like you kind of relate what you said at the time. I love when you're like, I said this, and then I said that. And that's fantastic. Yeah. I love it.
I feel like I was in the room with you. And I know that Karen watches a lot of shows with her kids. And, well, her older kid is off to college, but her daughter. And I love that this is a show that families can watch together, that it's not, you know – too racy or difficult, and that, you know, younger kids can get exposed to these big themes. It's lovely.
Yeah, it's great.
We won't tell your daughter that you were swearing, though. All right. I've got another voice message here. This one is from our friend Derek in Ireland.
Hi, I'm Anne Penny. This is Derek here in Dublin, sending you some feedback in for the Lord of the Rings of Power wrap-up podcast that you've got. I absolutely adored watching The Rings of Power every week. Such a great show, an absolute epic watching it. Felt like a movie every week. Everything from the score from Bear McCreary and Howard Shore's awesome theme, just setting it up every time, was really, really enjoyable. Loved Morfydd Clark and her version of Galadriel, this powerful leader and great fighter, kind of put out to pasture when her vengeance became a problem. Just one of my favorite early storylines for the show. You could just really feel her frustration about this idea that she knows Sauron's there in the background, that he has to be taken out. And then the quest that she goes on to save Middle-earth from the orc army and gathering all the Numenoreans together. But then it's all her fault. She's the one that mistakenly brings back Sauron to this newly formed Mordor. Just a really big, great arc for the show. Really enjoyed it. Loads of other great characters in the show as well. Arondir, the gorgeous, incredible elf. I could watch a whole show with him and Bronwyn battling orcs and bringing up Theo. Hope we get a lot more of them in season two. The Harfoots, particularly Nori and Poppy, were just the heart of the show. I loved watching their adventures and learning more about their nomadic ways and their mantra of nobody goes off trail and nobody walks alone, which kept the whole group alive for so long. But Nori was fighting against that idea of leaving people behind, that they should all work together. And now she's gone off with the stranger. It's really sad. It was a really touching moment when she left her family behind. But I was really sad to see that Poppy stayed behind as well, because it feels like the story of the Harfoots is kind of over as Nori goes off with the stranger. Their relationship and their dynamic has just been so lovely to watch throughout the season. So I do hope we check in with them in the future as well. I'll also miss Sadok Burrows. I loved Lenny Henry in this role. Really, really good. Could have done without his Irish accent, though. It was a bit distracting, as we've known Lenny Henry for so many years in various roles. And he doesn't do a great Irish accent, unfortunately. I did talk about this show for hours, but I will leave it with the excellent relationship between Elrond and Durin and Disa. Elrond and Durin having that rekindling of their old friendship and this idea of the eternal elves kind of not noticing 20 or 30 years passing by and the hurt that can cause to their friends. That was really good. And then just the supportive relationship between Disa and Durin, you could really feel their love come through the screen. Every scene they had together in the Mines of Moria, it was absolutely fantastic. The Mines of Moria themselves were amazing to see on screen. Really, really enjoyed that. Here's hoping poor Beric the Horse won't spend the next 2 years looking for Isildur as we wait for the next season of The Rings of Power to return. Thanks so much for the podcast as well. Really enjoyed listening to that every week just to round out my week of Lord of the Rings. Hoping to hear more from you guys soon. Bye.
Thanks, Derek.
Oh, thanks so much, Derek. It sounds like we're on the same page about some of the things there. And I was really pleased to hear your thoughts on the Irish accents as well with the Harfoots. Obviously, it didn't bother you too much with the rest of them, just with Sadok Burrows, Lenny Henry's portrayal, slightly different. And of course, Derek hosts his own podcast, the TV Podcast Industries. And I highly recommend those guys. They cover all kinds of shows. They've done Pennyworth, Umbrella Academy, pretty much every single Marvel show. They covered Rings of Power as well if you want to get some more Rings of Power fix. And they do a really great job over there. So go and have a wee look for TV Podcast Industries, and that'll fill you with some many more hours of happy listening.
And our final voicemail comes from former guest host, Lucy.
Lucy!
Hi, Anwen. Hi, Penny. It's Lucy from the Walking Dead cast here to offer some feedback on the overall season one wrap-up episode for The Rings of Power. I have been so bad at keeping up with my shows in the last 2 months because Deadcast is back, Lord of the Rings is on, Game of Thrones is finishing, and everything just feels like it's going full speed till Christmas. But last weekend, I did take the time to sit and watch the final two episodes of the series. I still loved it overall. I think it was a beautiful, beautiful show. I've never seen such a... Oh, my cat is disagreeing with me. I've never seen such a kind of wonderfully rendered world on screen, and I think it blew a lot of the effects in shows like House of the Dragon out of the water in terms of how it looked. There were some things that I think were maybe a bit more heavy-handed, and I think unfortunately the way I would think of this season as a whole is maybe just a little bit uneven. Like, when it was good, it was brilliant. So I really loved the Sauron reveal. I thought Morfydd Clark as Galadriel was wonderful. I really enjoyed every minute of Elrond and Durin. I thought that was all brilliant, but I had a harder time with the Harfoots. I found them less engaging. And I think my enjoyment of Numenor was just driven quite a lot by my deep-rooted love for Elendil and Isildur. As I kept telling my friends, those dudes could get it. Anyway, overall, I am looking forward to season two and spending some of that journey with you both. Thank you so much for giving us such fantastic coverage. It was a real privilege to be a guest host and to be able to discuss it with you both. Penny, I can't wait to see you in San Francisco. And Anwen, the road goes ever on and on till we meet again. Thanks for everything that you do. Love you loads.
Oh, thank you, Lucy. That's so lovely. And we really hope that you can find some space to guest on season two when that comes around. Who knows what other shows are going to be covered at that time. So we'll cross our fingers for you. Yeah, thank you.
Many years in the future. I have to agree with you about Elendil and Isildur. Very easy on the eyes, as is Isildur's friend Valandil. Quite handsome.
Yeah, yeah, he's a good Kiwi bloke, that one, the guy who plays Valandil. So it's nice to see New Zealand actors in there as well.
Yeah.
And yeah, I have to say Elendil for sure. Yeah. He's pretty gorgeous, isn't he?
Yeah. Isildur is just too young for me, but also quite beautiful. I can appreciate him from afar.
Yeah, for sure. Well, thanks everybody so much for the amazing feedback. If you do want to write in or leave us a message, you can do that at any time. You can find all of our contact information at podcastica.com, whether it's about a specific episode as you're watching it or whether it's the series in general, please let us know.
And while you're there, be sure to check out some of the other shows that Podcastica covers. As Lucy just mentioned, Walking Dead cast is going strong right now. There are only a few episodes left of The Walking Dead, and we're having a finale party in San Francisco. All the information about it is on podcastica.com if anybody doesn't know about it yet and decides they want to go. And there's other great stuff on Podcastica right now. We're covering Dead to Me, the Netflix show, and Jonathan and his friend James are covering Andor. Jonathan was one of our guest hosts on Cast of the Rings. Anwen, is there anything you're watching or listening to these days?
Oh, look, we are doing our best to catch up. We've also been quite behind. We finally finished Umbrella Academy last night, actually.
I loved Umbrella Academy.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting to see what they do with the final season. I think there's one more, maybe.
Yeah, I heard that.
But yeah, I didn't enjoy it as much as the other ones. But we are also catching up on Andor. We're only two episodes in, so apologies, Jonathan. I have been quite behind. I'm really keen to try and binge and get caught up with you guys for the final episode. We'll see what we can do over the next week. But so much out there, so much to listen to and watch. So we're never stuck for choice, are we?
No, we aren't. We're very lucky.
So next up on this podcast, we will be taking a break for a few weeks and hopefully coming back maybe in December to start our coverage of the Peter Jackson films, starting with The Lord of the Rings, The Fellowship of the Ring. And Penny, we'll have a chat about that. I think, is that news to you?
No.
I put that in the agenda. I'm like, yeah let's do it.
I knew we were doing the movies. I just didn't know if we were going to start with the Hobbit movies or the Lord of the Rings movies.
Yeah. I'm not sure. We'll have a chat about it, and we'll certainly let everybody know. But brush up on your stuff, and if you want to watch along with us, then we'll certainly let you know. We'll put a post out on all our usual Facebook pages to let you know what we're going to be doing. But we are really keen to hear your thoughts on them, so we'll give you a little bit of warning when we're going to do that, and you can watch. It's funny because I kind of always think of the Lord of the Rings movies first because they're released first. Yeah. But if we're doing it in chronological order, then it definitely makes sense to do The Hobbit. So let's see. We'll keep you posted.
Yeah, we'll let you know.
Yeah. All right, that's our show.
Thanks for joining us, everyone.
And remember, a burden shared may either be halved or doubled, depending on the heart that receives it.
And sometimes, to find the light, we must first touch the darkness.
The Humana Honor Medicare Advantage Plan gives you $1,860 back each year in your Social Security check. Choose coverage that helps you keep more money in your pocket. Learn more at GetHumana.com. Humana, a more human way to healthcare. The Part B Give Back benefit pays part or all of your Part B premium, and the amount may change based on the amount you pay for Part B. Limitations and restrictions may apply. Humana is a Medicare Advantage HMO and PPO organization with a Medicare contract. Enrollment in any Humana plan depends on contract renewal.
Most tax pros leave a message.
It's Jane. I'm moving on to a TurboTax expert who beat your price. Adam Devine, tell him how I feel.
Hey, tax pro, she's been thinking twice. Best believe TurboTax will beat your price. This is a tax break.
Switch to a TurboTax live expert and we'll beat what you paid your pro last tax season. Make the switch at TurboTax.com/beatyourprice. TurboTax full service only. Sign up by 12/20/2024 and file by 4/1/2025. Full details at TurboTax.com/beatyourprice.